Go ahead and call down these presentation materials and pull up our very first speaker's video. So as I do that, I'm going to replace the visuals here, and I'll go ahead and ask if Kent Glover from the U.S. Air Force, who is one of the, the FRTR Steering Committee Chair, if you can go ahead and get ready to provide your opening remarks.
Thank you, Jean. Welcome to the second session of the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable Fall Meeting. In response to the substantial interest voiced by many of the senior leaders in our member agencies, the fall meeting topic is remedy protectiveness and climate resilience in site cleanups. Last Monday, our first webinar session focused on developing a shared understanding of climate change challenges to site cleanup, and we'll have a recap of that session in a few minutes. Today, the second webinar session focuses on climate vulnerability assessment and adaptation to contaminated sites with a series of presentations of tools and case studies. Hopefully, overall, the two sessions provide a better understanding of three things: the need to advance technology of climate resilience in our cleanup efforts, where our agencies are in addressing the need, and how FRTR can contribute to efforts through interagency collaboration and technology transfer. To start us off, I'd like to introduce Larry Duchant, who is the director of the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Mr. Duchant has a distinguished career of federal service with the U.S. Navy Facilities Engineering Command, NAVFAC, and other organizations going back to 1989. From 2006 until recently, he was director of environmental programs at NAVFAC. Prior to federal service, he worked in the environmental consulting business and as a math and science teacher at Oakland, California Public Schools. Mr. Duchant holds a master's degree in environmental management from the University of San Francisco, and a bachelor's in nuclear engineering from UC Santa Barbara. He's a registered professional engineer. I met Larry a few years ago during a DoD Tri-Services Remedy Optimization meeting in the DC Navy Yard, and I found him both personable and perhaps as importantly, engaged in the technical topics of the meeting. And it is with this perspective that I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Duchant.
Thank you, Kent. Appreciate it very much. And hello, everyone, and thank you for joining the second part of the Fall 2021 Federal Remediation Technologies Roundtable, the focus of which is on climate resilience in site cleanup. As Director, Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, I welcome you to today's session, a follow-on to the great information and insights from last Monday. And a special thanks to our meeting organizers, participants, and presenters. I have been at EPA for the past 10 months, joining the Superfund program in January of this year. I came to EPA after 31 years in environmental management with the Department of Defense. And as Ken pointed out, my previous position before EPA was Director of Environmental Programs at Naval Facilities Engineering Systems Command. So I give a big hello to my NAVFAC colleagues attending this online roundtable today. I'm happy to be here to kick off the second part of the discussion on the important topic of building climate resilience in our site cleanup programs and to help ensure the continuing protectiveness of site remedies as the climate changes. As you know, President Biden and EPA Administrator Reagan have made addressing climate change a top priority. That's why one of my first actions last June was to issue a memorandum to EPA's 10 regions emphasizing the need to build resilience into our cleanups. In the memo, I also identified the existing authorities, processes, and the tools our remedial project managers have available to them to address climate resiliency. I was told during last Monday's proceedings, there were many excellent presentations demonstrating the efforts each of your agencies are undertaking to meet federal climate change directives. So today, please join me in hearing more about additional tools and specific case examples of how federal programs are addressing vulnerabilities, including the measures used to increase resilience at the site level. And so in closing, let me reiterate what a pleasure it is to kick off part two of the roundtable meeting. Enjoy the rest of the meeting, and thank you very much. And now I'll pass the meeting over to Cindy Frickle. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for that introduction, and we appreciate your support of the roundtable's efforts. So before we dive into today's content, I just want to give a short recap. So give me just a moment to share my screen. So I'll be giving a recap of last week's session. If you weren't able to make it to that one, just want to remind you that you will be able to find the archive recording on cluin.org in the archives section, or if you go to frtr.gov, it's also available there. So these slides will primarily be for your reference, but I just want to touch on a few key points. Let's see. There we go. Okay, so climate change is manifesting itself ever more clearly, and the urgency to address these impacts is reflected in federal guidance such as the Executive Order 14008. Our collective federal mission to clean up these contaminated sites has to address the effects on human health, environmental, and economic challenges of climate change. And we recognize in FRTR that our interagency sharing of climate adaption information, as well as tools and lessons learned, is absolutely critical to maximizing our return on the billions of dollars of federal money that are being injected annually to accomplishing these cleanups. Now, we've noticed that as all of these agencies are in the process of identifying priority actions that they'll be taking on in the next few years to address climate adaptation needs, this meeting is a great opportunity for us to share our resources and exchange our experiences. We've discovered many commonalities across our agency's climate action plans. So these include formulating or updating our climate adaptation policies, guidance, and decision-making tools, developing or updating climate vulnerability assessments to determine site-specific exposures to climate hazards, and increasing efforts to assure climate literacy and preparedness of our agency workers and partners. And of course, meaningfully engaging with communities on climate-related technical issues. Oops. Okay, so for those who are not able to attend our meeting last week, and as a reminder for those who did, we have created a kind of handbook of tools that are available for implementation by each of these agencies in the FRTR roundtable, and you can access these. This will be available by hyperlink in this presentation that I'm showing today, or you can also refer back to the additional resources that were included on last week's webinar and link to all those programs there. So we have there's a table of resources, tools, and guidance that each agency has available. These are all related to climate resilience. Oops. Okay, now assessing the change in climate condition at a site and how they affect a remedy is a core challenge that we all share in our site cleanup programs. There's a lot to share here, but in general, the strategies that we're using across the agencies includes assessing the vulnerability at a site of its cleanup remedies, identifying and prioritizing measures to increase resilience, and then building the adaptive capacity for projected climate scenarios. We see that we're using more information about the potential climate in the future, in addition to just looking at historical climate and weather data. And that's really going to help us model and assess the climate risks at our sites. Probably the most important aspect that we can pay attention to there is understanding the potential delta or change in those site conditions over remedies lifetime. So we can do that by using global climate models and looking at how they might respond to a wide ensemble of changes or scenarios, rather than just predicting a single climate condition at one point in time. And of course, we need to look at a range of models for analysis in order to better characterize this uncertainty and risks. One of the other things we touched on last week was a lot of the research that's going on right now. As a country, we're making significant investments in climate change research at the moment. And the good news is that the output of this research related to adaptation is often transferable between agencies. We saw that last week with Dr. Ryan Boyle's presentation from the USGS. These are a handful of other projects that are in the works. For example, with CERTP ESTCP, there are a handful of topics going on right now. There was a related project proposal request for this next year. And also there are various Superfund research program projects that involve climate change and effects at sites. So today we're going to hear more details about the vulnerability assessment tools, protocols, and case studies. This slide here includes some of the examples we will see, such as changes in vegetation cover, altered groundwater conditions, and saltwater intrusion. And with FRTR, we plan to continue sharing these case studies and lessons learned so that we can have a better cross-agency understanding of the direct and indirect impacts of climate change on site remedies. So with that, I would like to hand it over to our first presenter, Joel Sharaga. He is with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you very much, Cynthia. I'm Joel Sharaga, EPA Senior Advisor for Climate Adaptation, and it's truly an honor and a pleasure for me to be here with all of you this afternoon. As I jump into my presentation, I want to immediately acknowledge several people. First and foremost, Kent Glover and Larry Duchamp, thank you very much for the opportunity to spend some time with you today. I also really want to thank my colleague, Carlos Pachon, who works in the Superfund program at EPA, who's been working on adaptation issues with us related to the Superfund program going all the way back to 2011. So, Carlos, thank you. And finally, my colleague Ken Muniz, who is online with me right now, who's one of the architects of the system, the ARCHEC system you'll hear about today. In my presentation today, I'd like to present the ARCHEC system to you. And this is a system that we at EPA launched all the way back in October 2016, and it has been growing over time. And the punchline is that the ARCHEC system is designed to empower local government officials like mayors and county executives in all 40,000 communities across the United States to anticipate prepare for, and adapt to climate change. As you will see in a few minutes, I'll do an actual demo of the ARCHEC system, and I'll actually be tying it to a presentation you'll hear later on from Ben Rasmussen and Chris Cutler-Wood, our colleagues at DOT. So you'll see how we've been trying very hard to leverage the incredibly successful work being done at other agencies on adaptation resilience, like at DOT. But I'd like to start out for you by motivating for you why we felt the need back in 2016 to develop the ARCHEC system, given the huge number of resources already out there on a huge number of websites dealing with climate adaptation. So I want to motivate this for you. Next slide, please. The starting point is what our goal is at EPA. In the adaptation program. Our goal at the end of the day is to empower all 40,000 communities across the nation to anticipate, prepare for, and adapt to the impacts of climate change. And as you can imagine, that's a daunting task. It's not an easy thing to do. Next slide, please. The way we've gone about doing this, going back over a decade, is to try to support the efforts of all those communities by providing an array of resources that, again, would empower them, given their particular needs in their own communities to prepare for the impacts of climate change. And we've done that historically through a number of different mechanisms. First and foremost, by providing training. Carlos Pachon, for example, in our Superfund program, has done a lot of work trying to provide the training to Superfund managers, both inside EPA as well as across the country, to help increase their awareness of the ways climate change can, in fact, affect their ability to implement effective cleanup programs and to ensure that they're resilient over time as the climate changes. In addition, we've been producing and providing the tools and technical support that we hear from our stakeholders that they need in order to prepare for the impacts of climate change. And I can't overemphasize that. We're not prescriptive. We do a lot of listening to our stakeholders to try to understand from them what they need in order to adapt to a changing climate. And finally, not surprising, as you can imagine, we always hear from people, we need financial resources. So we've tried to provide financial incentives to support climate resilient investments in these 40,000 communities across the country. Next slide, please. As we've looked at how effective we and other federal agencies have been, we've discovered that there already are some incredible success stories across the country. This is one example. This is one of my favorite examples up in Boston. The Massachusetts Water Resources Authority, going all the way back to 1989, recognized that they were investing almost $4 billion to update their Deer Island wastewater treatment plant in Boston Harbor. The city had grown a lot larger than when that facility was first built, and they had to increase the size of the facility. They also recognized, though, to their credit, that they were vulnerable to the impacts of climate change, in fact, vulnerable to sea level rise and storm surge, because the wastewater treatment plant is, in fact, sitting on an island. And they had the foresight to, using available sea level rise scenarios, to prepare for the future. And they actually made the incremental investment to elevate parts of that facility by almost 2 feet in order to ensure that it would be resilient over the lifetime of the plant. That's a success story, and there are a lot of them out there. Next slide, please. But one of the problems, as we went out and we listened to communities, one of the problems that we heard was that many of the communities out there are still struggling to adapt. And at the bottom of that slide, you see a real quote from a number of years ago, from I believe it was back in 2015, from a climate leadership conference in California. Everybody attending the conference were supporters of dealing with climate change, both mitigation and adaptation. We as a federal family were presenting the array of tools that we were already producing in order to support their efforts. And I'll never forget at the end of the session I was in, a county executive from California got up and he said, and that's the real quote, "We don't need any more stinking tools. What we need is the technical assistance to understand of the thousands of tools already out there, which ones are the right ones for us to use given the issues of concern to us. And then we need the technical support to understand how to actually use those tools." That was a wake-up call to us. And we did some more digging and we went out and we talked to a lot of the mayors and county executives across the country. And what we discovered was most of the states and communities out there are not the New York Cities and the Chicagos and the San Franciscos that already have a wealth of expertise and experience dealing with adaptation. Most of the 40,000 communities are middle to smaller size communities that do not have that sort of expertise and experience dealing with climate impacts. In addition, what we heard from a lot of these well-informed executives, local government officials, was they were aware there's a lot of information out there, but they're overwhelmed by it all. They said, look, a lot of this information isn't relevant to us where we live and given the particular issues of concern to our own community. And even if we can find the information that's relevant to us, we don't know how to integrate it into a single integrated package that will lead us soup to nuts, from understanding why climate change matters for the issues that we care about, to what the adaptation strategies are that we could decide to implement, and then to understand how to actually implement them in practice. That is what motivated for us the development of the ARC-X system. Next slide, please. The ARC-X system is in fact designed to address that issue, and it's unlike, to the best of our knowledge, any other resource that's currently available to the public. Next slide. What you'll see in a minute is that, the ARC-X system is designed for local government officials. It's not for the general public. It's for local government officials like mayors and county executives in all of the communities across the nation. And again, as you'll see in my demo momentarily, once the local government official self-identifies in the sense of showing us where they live in the country, what region of the country their community is in, and then identifies for us the array of issues that are of particular interest to them, the system instantaneously provides them with the type of integrated package of information I was alluding to earlier, and actually links them, as you can see highlighted in blue, it actually links them to the relevant tools and technical support that they can use that are available from EPA and from other federal agencies in order to actually implement those adaptation strategies. The proof is always in the pudding. We've been tracking how well the system is doing, and usage of the system has grown from approximately 10,000 unique repeat users back in 2016 to over 40,000 every year this year. Next slide, please. One last quick background information before I launch into the demo. Clearly, the ARC-X system is a national system. We're trying to share information that is useful to communities all across the country. But as we actually implemented the system, we discovered, we were aware, we can't do the deep dive into any one state, into all of the issues of concern to communities in that particular state. So we made a decision back in 2017, given that the taxpayer has paid for the development of this system, we've made the offer to provide the code and the content of the system to any host university, a lead host university in each state, free of charge, in order to develop a state-level version of the system. And I'm happy to say that in Indiana, the University of Indiana has already launched their system called the ERIT system, which is their state-level version of the ARC-X system, and we have other state-level versions already under development, but that offer still stands for the rest of the nation. Next slide, please. So with that, I'm going to try to provide you with a very quick demo of the ARC-X system. There's a lot of detail to it, but I'll try to give you a flavor for how we, in fact, provide this integrated package of information to the users. And I'm going to try to share my screen now, and this is always the fun part. And it worked magically. Wow. This is always the scary part, trying to use Zoom and Teams systems to actually share screens. This is, in fact, the ARC-X system on the EPA website. And as you can see, there's a lot of information in here. But for the purposes of this demo, I want to focus on the heart of the system, the Tailor Your Search system. And this is the system that allows the user to request information tailored specifically to where they live and their needs. And I'm going to click on the map to get the system going. Right away, the user, the mayor, let's say, is brought to this system where they can self-identify, where on the left-hand side, they can show us what region of the United States their community is in. And then on the right-hand side, we give them an array of issues of potential interest to them, in this case, consistent with EPA's mission. And for demo purposes, let me pick the Southwest, because again, I'm going to try to link my demo to the beautiful case study you're going to hear about later on from my colleagues at DOT. And I'm going to say our mayor is interested in the potential impacts of climate change on outdoor air quality. Now, clearly, the user can click a lot of the other things as well. But again, to keep things simple for this demo, we'll limit it to outdoor air quality. And let me hit the submit button. And right away, you see that the system brings up that integrated package of information tailored specifically to this mayor's needs. And it leads them by a thread through this array of from understanding why climate change matters for the issues that that mayor had just told us he cared about, to the available adaptation strategies that are out there. And if the mayor chooses to try to implement or to pursue one or more that those adaptation strategies, we then bring the mayor to case studies of other communities that have dealt with similar issues, similar air quality issues, and have already successfully implemented adaptation strategies. But these are more than just stories. What you will see in a minute is these case studies, the heart of the system, then takes them to the steps that that mayor's community can take in order to replicate the success that this other community has already had, and then leads them for each of those steps to available tools from EPA and others to implement those steps. And finally, we also provide training that can be used by the mayor to train staff on adaptation, as well as to available funding from EPA and other federal agencies in order to pay for the adaptation. So let me start with step one, following that thread. I'm going to role play that mayor. I want to understand why climate change matters for air quality in my community. So I click on that. And right away, you can see coming up in plain English, not a lot of technical information, although that can be, there are links to that technical information in the system. But for the purposes of the mayor, to try to increase awareness of why climate change matters for things like ground level ozone, for things like particulate matter in that mayor's community. Once the mayor has read that, if the mayor decides to proceed, if the mayor says, wow, maybe I should pay attention to climate change and think about how to anticipate and prepare for it, I'm then taken to what can I do about it? What are available adaptation strategies? And I click on that, and you can see that what comes up for outdoor air is a whole array of different adaptation strategies that can be implemented by that community in order to deal with the impacts of climate change on outdoor air quality, on things like ozone and particulate matter. And I just want to highlight for you here, and this is where we hope to enhance our system, to linking to tools and information available from the Department of Transportation and others, you can see that there are mechanisms, adaptation strategies that can be used to deal with transportation in order to help improve air quality over time. If the mayor at that point says, gee, you know, looks to me like there are options out there that I can consider, how do I actually do it in practice? What other communities already out there have successfully implemented some of these adaptation strategies? And as you can see here, we have a list of three right here. And one of them is, in fact, the case study you'll hear about in a little while from my colleagues at DOT. And I think this is just a magnificent success story where the federal government, the Department of Transportation, EPA, and others engaged with the community, as with the region, as well as stakeholders in the region, in order to develop an effective adaptation plan for anticipating and preparing for the impacts of climate change. And as you can see, again, our mayor is presented a story in plain English. What happened out there? Why this was so successful? But again, we don't stop there. We then have down here, what we, internally we like to call the quick start guide, very similar to the quick start guide you get when you buy a new television set or some other appliance. You don't want to read all the detailed technical information right off the bat. You want to know, what are the key steps that I have to take in order to replicate what was done in the New Mexico region. And there are a couple of major steps here. And as you can see, for each of these steps, we link to at least one of the available tools, in this case from EPA. You can see that we immediately take them to an actual guide we have for communities on how to anticipate and prepare for climate impacts by dealing with transportation. You can also see here for this step here, we have links to other information that is available, other tools that are available from EPA. So again, we're trying to be responsive to what we heard a number of years ago. We're overwhelmed by all the tools out there. Which are the right tools for the issues of concern to us? Finally, staying within the case study section, we also want to increase the awareness of the mayor that there are other case studies out there that he or she can look at. For example, Salt Lake City has also dealt with similar issues, and the mayor could go there as well. Very quickly, I mentioned that we didn't want to overwhelm at the level of a mayor or a county executive. We didn't want to overwhelm them with a lot of technical information, recognizing they'll probably hand this off to somebody in one of their departments or agencies to actually do it, to implement these things in practice. But throughout the system, we do make links to more technical information for those experts who are handed the job of implementing the adaptation strategies. Very quickly, and I won't go into this in a lot of detail, we do then lead that thread then leads the mayor to a much wider array of tools that are available from the federal family in order to implement these adaptation strategies. If we dove into it here, and again, to be respectful of time, I won't do it, you would see a whole system, a whole list of tools, but also a description of the tool, identification of who at EPA or what program at EPA that individual could contact, along with email addresses and phone numbers in order to get technical support for implementing that tool, and where available, also any training modules that exist for actually implementing those tools. And again, you can see some of the training will be listed here. Finally, a couple last things, and I'll take questions. As I said, we also recognize that adaptation costs money and that very often we in the federal government are looked to for resources. And the user can go and look at and see what sort of funding is available from EPA, can also see what federal funding is available from other federal agencies, recognizing, of course, that we're not the only entity out there that provides funds for the implementation of adaptation strategies. Finally, last but not least, we link the user to the EPA regional office for their particular state. Here you can see New Mexico is in EPA Region 6. We provide the actual name and phone number of a staff person in Region 6 who can now help that user, that mayor or county executive, with any issues of concern, as well as to the climate adaptation implementation plan that the regional office has. And not last but not least, and this is where I'll stop, dose of humility for us. We recognize, again, we're not the only source of information, that many of the states across the nation already have their own adaptation websites and their own resources and tools available for the implementation of adaptation strategies. And where those are available, we provide the links to that state system. So with that I realize I've dumped a lot on you very, very quickly, but I wanted to give you a quick flavor for what the EPA's ARC-EX system looks like, why we developed it, and what it is capable of doing to provide this integrated power of information to empower all 40,000 communities to deal with the potential impacts of climate change. With that, let me stop, and Jean, I'll open it up to any questions that may have come up.
All right, thank you so much. Before we jump into those questions, I did just want to make a quick note. Again, Ken Muniz, your colleague, is on the line. So Ken, if you want to unmute or come on camera in case you can assist with some of these questions, please feel free. I'll make sure that the audience can connect with you as well. And as I'm doing that there, we've got a visual. Ken, if you want to tip that camera a little bit lower. Excellent.
And I will simply acknowledge Ken is one of the architects who helped design this system. We couldn't have done it without him. So with that, again, I'll turn it back to you.
All right, excellent. Thank you. So there are a number of questions that have come in, and I'm going to start reading through these. Just a gentle reminder for the audience, you can keep typing them into that Q&A window in Zoom, and then we'll read through these. So I think you've hit on this, but just to reinforce, an overwhelming number of people wanted to ensure that this is free, that they don't have to pay to use this.
Great question. Yes, this system is already online on the EPA website at epa.gov/ARCX, and it is free of charge. Absolutely.
Okay. And does it work on mobile devices, mobile browsers?
Yes, it does. In fact, I could pull it up on my iPhone right now. It does. And we are also, and again, because of the limitations of time, I won't go into this in great detail, but we are also developing an app that potential developers of state level versions can use to develop their own state level versions much more easily than in the past.
Okay. We have a question. Is there a list of the quote host universities and a description of how a university might become a host if they're not already in there?
Yes, we can get that information to anybody. I'd be glad to provide it and answer any questions we don't have time to get to. If people contact me or Ken Muniz directly at EPA, we will get you that list. And we can also provide you for information, not just on how to become a host university, but also some of our requests of them. And you probably saw that on one of my slides. For example, Indiana recognized that they weren't the only university in the state, and some other universities in the state, like Purdue, had expertise on climate science that they didn't. So we encouraged them to partner, which they did. We also encourage host universities to work collaboratively with historically Black colleges and universities, as well as other minority colleges, because again, they bring expertise and a perspective that the host university may not have. But please contact me directly and I'll get you that information.
Okay. There was a question, does ARCX include quantifiable metrics that were developed to track progress or pause points for corrective actions?
Great question. The answer is currently no, but that is in fact under development. We're actually developing some of those metrics ourselves right now within EPA to determine how to actually assess progress on the ground. Clearly, we can use Google Analytics to see how many people are actually accessing the system. But what we really want to begin to assess is, have we made a difference on the ground? Mm-hmm. And we're developing those metrics right now, thinking about how to build them into this system, as well as to build in indices, resilience indices, that can track how resilient communities are becoming over time. And we're not the only ones, clearly not the only ones working on those sorts of indices across the nation right now.
Okay. I think at one point in your demo, you had scrolled through a section that talked about training.
Yes.
And this attendee was asking to learn a little bit more about that training. Is it free? Is this in person, online?
Another great question. What is currently in the ARCX is everything's free. Let me be very upfront. Taxpayer has paid for all of this, and we want to make it accessible to everybody. The training that you will see in the ARCX system right now, which is somewhat limited, is in fact our online training modules. For example, we have one built into there that can be used by water resource managers to understand how to deal with the impacts of climate change. One of the investments that we are currently making at EPA, which is actually captured in our new strategic plan, which is currently out for public review in draft form. One of the commitments we have made is to develop more training that will in fact be built into the ArcX system. We're also looking at other types of training like webinars and in-person training as well.
Okay, great. We've had some questions about updates to the system. So people are interested in how frequently it's updated, and then when you do update it, how are you updating the data and the system itself?
The answer is yes, we're constantly updating it for several different reasons. Number one, the science clearly is evolving over time. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we're doing right now is to ensure that the information that's in the ArcX system is consistent with the fourth U.S. National Climate Assessment, as well as the most recent IPCC Climate Science Report. So that sort of updating is going on. We're also constantly developing new case studies, working with our regional offices and their partners in the states and the communities, who are also working with different federal agencies like FEMA and DOT in order to identify case studies that we build in on a regular basis into the system. Folks may have noticed at the very top of I can actually scroll up. You can see here updates that we have at the top of the ArcX system. And some of those updates are, hey, we've got a new case study that has been built into the system. We also have a listserv, and if people sign up for the listserv, they will get notifications of any updates to the system. And last but not least, we are also in the process of developing a version 2 of the ArcX system to do things like build in capabilities for looking at how to address and achieve environmental justice through adaptation strategies. And we're also building in an approach to also empower businesses in these communities to anticipate and prepare for climate change. We've heard from some major corporations that this type of information would be helpful to them as well as members of the communities. So yes, hopefully sometime in the near future in 2022, you'll see a version 2 of the system.
Okay. There were some questions though about just scalability or the ability to sort of customize its outputs for locations that might be experiencing something different. So in the example, in one of these questions, they wanted to know if ArcX can downscale for locations like Alaskan villages that might be right on the forefront and their climate change issues are perhaps being felt in different ways than other communities.
Great question. And clearly that's a challenge. One size doesn't fit all. Mm-hmm. I guess a two-part answer. First of all, as an aside, we are currently in discussions with our tribal partners at EPA to think about how to develop capabilities in the ArcX system for tribes, which is a major challenge because there are approximately 574 tribes, and they're all unique. And that in itself, it makes it challenging to provide information that multiple tribes can use. But we are looking at tribes. But coming back to the scalability question, it's a major challenge. And I guess the best way I can put it in is to say it's captured within the case studies. And it really depends on the scale of the case studies themselves that are in the system. Over time, we're populating the system with more case studies. We're also working with our state level versions to benefit from the case studies that they develop, which will be at a more refined scale in many cases than what we get at with this national version. But I'm not going to blow smoke in anybody's face. The scalability issue is a major challenge, and this won't answer every question or every challenge that every single community at different scales may be facing, okay. Meaning like communities within communities. It can be a challenge.
Okay. Well, I think the last grouping of questions I have is probably the most popular theme that I'm seeing coming in here. And that gets back to cost-benefit analysis. So a number of people have asked if you have either reliable risk cost-benefit analysis in there, or if you are talking about tools for the local executives to sort of assess the risk of these negative potential effects so they can judge whether or not that investment is going to be worth the benefit that they would get. And then there are people just like, do you have specific quantified case studies that talk about the financial benefits based off of what they've invested to avoid that risk?
No, thank you for that. And again, that is something that we are focusing on to a much greater extent in version two, the updated version. When we first built this system, we did it in partnership and with advice from our local government advisory committee, a FACA committee, with representatives such as mayors and county executives across the country. And they asked for exactly that sort of information. They said the extent to which, number one, you can provide top dollar information, cost information in your case studies, please do so. And we have that to a limited extent already in our case studies. In terms of assessing, doing benefit cost analysis, we have not done that. It is certainly something that we hope to build into the system, but we weren't able to do that in version one. But these are exactly the sorts of enhancements that, as we hear from people, would be helpful to them. We do fully intend to build into the system. And I'll, since you said that was the last group of questions, let me just say also that, as I alluded to before, we've built in a development and use of the ARC-X system, both at the national level as well as at the state levels, into our strategic plan, our new strategic plan at EPA. And what that means is we are very hopeful that because of that, we'll have additional resources in order to invest in these sorts of needs as we hear those needs from our users. So please don't be shy about letting us know what sorts of enhancements would be of greatest benefit to you.
Excellent. Well, with that, Joel, I want to thank you so much. I think you can certainly put that in the requested enhancements column based off of some of the questions I got here.
Absolutely.
I think at this point, we'll go ahead and ask our next pair of speakers. Is that okay?
And I believe the next speaker is in fact, Carlos. And I've already mentioned Carlos Pichon. Is that right, Jean?
That's correct.
As I said, Carlos Pichon, who is at EPA in the Superfund program, has been a leader on the work that we've been doing in the Superfund program to anticipate and prepare for the impacts of climate change. And I'll probably even embarrass Carlos a little bit by saying we've even gotten scrutiny from the GAO that did an assessment of the progress that Carlos and the entire Superfund program has made over the last few years. And it was a very, very positive assessment. Clearly, they identified continual improvements we can make, but it really was a testament to the great work Carlos has done. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, Carlos.
Thank you very much. And for us, it was a pleasure to and an honor to have you with us today, Joel. As you all may know, Joel is a very busy person, leading, amongst others, the development of the agency of the EPA agency-wide climate adaptation plan. So thank you for squeezing this time with us in today. And I'm going to go ahead and see if I can seamlessly share my screen. And I select this one, and I share, and hopefully it's coming across. You can confirm that, Jean?
Yes, we can. We have your slides.
Great. Thank you. So I'll be speaking today along with Sean Dubois. He's from ICF. Just so you know, Sean is one of the folks that's been helping us for a few years now on off-site optimization, the optimization efforts we undertake in the Superfund program. And we have found a lot of similarities in conducting an optimization vis-a-vis conducting a vulnerability screening assessment. So we certainly are leveraging that expertise and that experience we have across 300 approximately optimizations. Excuse me. And Sean is transferring a lot of that expertise and leading that effort with us over at ICF. Sean is an undergrad in Earth Systems Science from University of Michigan and a graduate degree in Environmental Sciences from the University of Wisconsin. So I'll hand it off to Sean in just a couple of minutes, but first I'd like to introduce the topic of Protocol for Climate Vulnerability Screening at Contaminated Sites. Also, mentioned that this at this point, we're starting to get down sites specifically and getting quite focused. Fortunately, there are a lot of resources like the ones that we heard about last week The ones that are compiled in the in that matrix of federal agency tools, guidance, and resources, as well as the ones that Joel discussed earlier today that are in ArcX. However, there comes a point where we want to start asking very specific questions about the resources that are on those platforms. And maybe this is a bit of a protocol, might be a bit too much of a word for what we're going to discuss, but I think it's descriptive of what we are talking about. Quick recap of some of the information we shared last week. One is the memo that Larry mentioned in the opening remarks, one of the first things he did related to climate on joining the agency. And it's that, that memo that was put out to the regions that reiterates the authorities that we have to address climate at our sites and outlines the process that we're going to discuss today and discusses the technical support available to remedial project managers. So as we have said last week, clearly, we did an analysis of CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Risk Compensation Liability Act, basically the law that created Superfund and National Contingency Plan that rolls out the guidelines. It has a clear foundational basis for the consideration of potential extreme weather and climate impacts at Superfund sites. Basically, you can take it down to the question of long-term and short-term protectiveness. In other words, if we select a remedy, or build and operate a remedy that is not protective in the short term or long term, we are being inconsistent with CERCLA and the NCP. That's at the root, that's where the authority comes from and the requirement to ensure that we are protective. Now, when should we be doing this? We've talked about also, and I'm trying to be succinct here, up through the remedial investigation. So even in the hazard, in the site ranking process, there are opportunities and needs to consider both current and projected climate conditions at the site, as well as in the feasibility study and leading up to remedial remedy selection and then design of the selected remedy. And later this afternoon, I'll have a chance to describe some examples of how that has played out at Superfund sites. And then, of course, in the remedial action and through operation maintenance, we want to know if the remedy is continued to be protective or if site conditions have changed in a manner that we need to take action to ensure that continued resilience. So it's never too late, but it's never too early to consider projected climate conditions at the site. Now, one thing that headquarters Superfund program is doing is providing that climate vulnerability assessment tech support. And that's where we have learned, the experiences that we're going to describe to you today are based on what we learned so far in that vulnerability assessment. So basically, there's a key message to take away from here. There's two key questions that we want to ask. Cindy mentioned it early on in her recap from last week, but one of the main core questions related to climate impacts at contaminated site cleanups is, what does a forward-looking climate analysis tell us about conditions at our site? And what is the delta over current conditions? So basically, that's the first one. What is going to be different going forward? And the second one, of course, once we have that in hand, is how does that delta affect the remedy decision, site operations, et cetera? So it's a two-part question. The first is, as the graph on the right suggests, we historically have always looked at climate. The question is, how is it going to be different in the time period that we're making a decision for? Now, we've heard a lot about the resources that are available to others, out there. But one of another important point we found is that expertise is needed in climate analysis, in mapping, and GIS, and in contaminated science and engineering. Three types of independent engineering expertise that often are not found together, have not traditionally worked together. So we've also found that having a standing team of this expertise capable of going from one site to another to do that screening assessment is very cost effective versus having these folks come together for a one-off to do a vulnerability screening. For now, that is our finding. We think that may change as we all get more experience in assessing the climate vulnerabilities. But for now, that is a process that we think will be cost effective going forward. So what is it that we are looking at? Again, this is a slide we shared last week. Today we're going to focus on these first two boxes, and then later in the afternoon, I'll give some examples of implemented measures. But basically, the points we want to look at is how we assess an exposure, a climate exposure, and how we conduct a sensitivity of a remedy's protectiveness to that exposure. Based on that, we can look at potential measures that might be developed, adaptation measures that might be put in place, what they bias as far as increased resilience to those exposures, and then put those in place and then periodically reassess the process. So this whole effort is, this whole process is what I'm gonna ask Sean to talk us through. As I said, he's boiled down our, you know, some experiences we have had so far. And Sean, if I may hand it over to you, I'll remain available to answer questions at the end. So Sean, thank you.
Great, thanks, Carlos. Can everyone see my slides?
Yes, we can.
Great, thank you. As Carlos mentioned, this tech support offered to site managers brings together climate experts and remediation experts to examine projected site conditions and remedy components, and then determine potential resilience measures to be implemented at the site. So again, the conversations between the site team, those who know the site best, and experts assisting with the assessment are crucial to deliver assessment results that are most useful to the site manager. So I'll briefly walk through the key considerations for some of these steps of the assessment process and offer specific examples from an assessment currently being performed at an EPA Superfund site. So the climate exposure analysis should identify specific climate hazards of concern for the site, primarily those expected to increase in frequency or severity, and provide projections that can be used later on in the assessment to determine vulnerabilities. When determining the climate hazards of interest for a site, you'll want to look at previous instances of natural disasters, extreme weather events, and long-term climate events such as drought, and assess their potential to change in future climate scenarios. Furthermore, site managers should communicate these considerations with any climate experts assisting with the assessment. And while it's useful to screen for all potential climate hazards, in order to identify any changes to climate conditions not previously considered, it is important to understand the specific concerns from the site manager to better apply an in-depth review for those specific hazards. Finally, the climate exposure analysis can often use readily available online screening tools or use climate models that can be tailored to a specific site's geography and focus results relevant to the site needs. Here are two examples of what these kinds of climate models can provide. For the site we're working on, we use model projections to better understand anticipated changes in temperature and precipitation. And you'll want to tailor model results specifically for the site to identify the climate parameters of most interest and use when later looking at the remedy vulnerabilities. The results can provide an ability to generate high resolution data when using model results. So there's a benefit to getting access to model data if that's a possibility for your site. But whether it's online screening tools or model data that's tailored to your site, it's important to use site-specific data as opposed to data scaled to the regional level. Additionally, you'll want to use climate projections at a time frame relevant to your site's remedy. As Carlos mentioned, for example, if your remedy is anticipated to be in place for 30 years, you want to look at climate projections around 2050 or beyond. And finally, we typically suggest screening a site using climate projections under the more extreme scenarios to ensure that no climate hazards are inadvertently missed in this screening process. Note that not all climate screening tools incorporate forward-looking data. You may need to understand current conditions and then consider how these conditions might change under future projections. For example, you may have to infer changes to stream flow, wildfire, and other parameters based off model projections for extreme rainfall events, temperature, and drought. Next in the process is the analysis of remedy sensitivities. This can be performed simultaneously with the climate exposure analysis. And the focus involves assessing the likelihood of a specific hazard to reduce the remedy's effectiveness. Sensitivity analyses are always performed when designing and assessing the remedy, but this specific analysis, as part of a climate vulnerability assessment, focuses on sensitivities that may be influenced by a changing climate. So you want to consider how a remedy was designed. Was current or future climate data incorporated into the remedy design? For example, site flood controls used to prevent site runoff may be sensitive to an increase in extreme rainfall events and may be possible to identify the rainfall amounts the flood controls were designed to handle. And that can be compared against any model precipitation projections. Furthermore, you may want to consider how remedies fared during previous extreme weather events or during long-term climate events. Again, you'll want to ask if these events increase in severity, would the remedy's effectiveness be at risk? And it may be useful to solicitate the advice of remediation experts familiar with the site to better understand how components were designed and built and what sort of inherent sensitivities exist for your remedy components. So when identifying scenarios that will affect the effectiveness of your remedy, you want to look at both the system and the hazardous waste profile. For example, in addition to the physical damage of system infrastructure, the effectiveness of the groundwater pump and treat system is sensitive to power interruptions to the local grid, which has occurred in the past for the site we're looking at, and changes in hydrogeologic conditions, including water table depth and plume flow. Other identified sensitivities include erosion of vegetative cover from loss of vegetation or increased runoff, a scouring of a sand cap in place, or fluctuations in the water level that may increase mercury methylation rates. And finally, erosion of former waste channels at the site that could carry contaminated media into the floodplain. After developing an understanding of future climate exposure and the sensitivity of current or planned remedies, you can now identify system vulnerabilities to climate change. Vulnerability is the intersection of remedy sensitivities and climate exposure. And this chart visually represents this intersection and calls attention to the vulnerabilities that may need to be addressed. For example, that you may have low sensitivity combined with high exposure, you may not need to be as concerned with that, or vice versa, high exposure but low remedy sensitivity, while focusing in on the vulnerabilities where there's medium to high sensitivity and medium to high anticipated change in that climate exposure. So the final step of the assessment is, of course, the most important and involves the identification, prioritization, and implementation of resilience measures to address the identified vulnerabilities. Shown here are example high-level measures that could be considered to address the identified vulnerabilities. For example, drainage ditches and former waste channels may be addressed by the installation of new runoff channels to prevent excessive runoff from reaching the existing channels, or installing erosion-resistant lining to the existing channels designed specifically for the projected increase in precipitation and runoff. You want to incorporate specific drought-resistant plants in order to withstand projected increases in temperature and drought to address the vegetated landfill covers. And finally, we would want to consider options for backup power to the groundwater pump and treat system in order to avoid power interruptions, which has occurred in the past and is likely to increase with extreme temperature events. That's all I have. I hope we have time for a question or two before going to break.
All right, thanks so much, Sean. I think we do have time to take just a few questions before our brief break. So there were a couple of questions about elements that are included when one is doing analysis like this. And so one of the attendees just asked, you know, in addition to looking at rainfall and temperature, do you think that it would also be helpful to consider the frequency or the time frame between some of these impact, these extreme weather events? Is that a variable that you're looking at?
Definitely. And I think that's the benefit of being able to incorporate some climate experts to provide those suggestions. Obviously, I just mentioned temperature and precipitation, but again, going into the specific parameters, are you looking at increases in a 100-year storm event or the number of days consecutive with rain? And whatever is most important to your remedy is kind of where you're going to want to instruct any climate experts assisting you, with you to generate projections that are most relevant to your remedy. So that's where that ongoing conversation between the site manager who knows the site best and remediation and climate experts can really help in identifying parameters, then sensitivities and vulnerabilities that are most important.
Yeah, and if I may, Sean, thanks for that. Just what we showed today are some summary of the findings. The analysis was broader. Often we come up like there's nothing to worry about. The delta, either there's not that significant a change or the change is not going to affect the remedy components. But those two points that were made were certainly ones that we looked at, yes. And that's one of the challenges is scoping. Where do we stop looking? Or how do we effectively identify those intersections between between climate change and remedy sensitivities? That's okay. Really one of the challenges where we're trying to gain efficiencies. Good question. Okay. Thank you.
Do you think that five-year reviews will start looking at or talking about assessments or impacts for climate change?
Yeah, we believe so, and they have. This afternoon or in an hour or so, I have some examples of how that is playing out. The five-year review guidance, there was an update. I think it's 3C, question 3C. Has any new information become available that may indicate impairedness of the protectiveness? So definitely it's already in there. And an analysis such as this one would be very opportune if there's such an indication, such as climate change at a site. So, yes.
Okay. And then similarly, when you're looking at remedy selection, is climate change part of the dialogue as part of the remedy selection process at Superfund?
Yes, we're seeing it increasingly so. Again, I have some examples later today of how climate has is actually included as in different parts of the record of decision. Again, the point that we will try to make is that climate is already considered in OR processes. The question is the delta in forward-looking projections being factored in? And we are seeing more and more of that, yes.
Okay. There are a number of sort of specific questions that are still in the queue about whether or not these tools were looked at or you addressed these items in your analysis. And I'll just ask generically, if people had additional questions about the work, Carlos, could they reach out to you directly for more
information? Yes, please do. Okay. Be happy to share it with them. Thank you.
Okay. But one simple question, I think, someone wanted you just to clarify, what are the recommended forward climate models in projecting forward for events?
That's
maybe I guessed wrong.
Yes. And that's exactly why we need those experts and that conversation between the climate scientists and the remedy engineer and the site manager, because there are multiple considerations that will inform which is the optimal, not the best, but the optimal for the decision that's being made.
Okay. All right. Well, I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and conclude this portion of the meeting today. But I do want to make sure that we give everybody just a few moments to step away from their devices for a quick break. So I'm going to call up on the screen some of our agency announcements from the FRTR member agencies. And while I do that, I will just let the audience know we'll take about a 2-minute break here. So you can step away, use the facilities, or stay connected. There'll be some hold music during the break. And then we will resume around 2:16 p.m. Eastern to carry on with our next set of speakers in today's FRTR meeting. right. I don't know about you. I know that 2 minutes went pretty quickly for myself, but I think in the interest of time, we can go ahead and welcome everyone back so we can carry on with our session today. So next on the agenda, our two speakers will be joining us from the U.S. Department of Transportation. And I can see, Ben, your video is up. Let me go ahead and spotlight you for everyone. And then I will go ahead and encourage you to place your video source on. I can see your colleague, Chris, your video is up as well. So Chris, welcome. Thanks for joining us. And Ben, I can see your slides. If you want to try that full slideshow mode, go right ahead. All right, excellent. So feel free, gentlemen, I'll turn it back over to you to carry on with today's FRTR meeting.
All right, thanks, Jean. And thank you everyone for inviting us here today. I'm Ben Rasmussen from the U.S. Department of Transportation Volpe Center, which is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is where my colleague Chris is near. I'm in Minnesota. I work remotely out here for the last 10 years. And I'm going to be giving the bulk of the presentation, and then Chris is here to help me with Q&A later on. So to start, give a little background about these climate change scenario planning projects. The focus of our work, and this was about 8 years ago or so, was 50% on adaptation, 50% on mitigation. We used scenario planning as a framework to try to play out different scenarios that we could plan for, given that there was uncertainty in many climate models. The goal was to integrate our results into long-range transportation plans, specifically in the regions that we selected. And we worked with multiple agencies that had different priorities, sometimes not just transportation. It could be energy, land use, et cetera. Our first location was on the coast. It was Cape Cod, Massachusetts, about 10 years ago. And our second location was in central New Mexico, starting in 2013. The main goals here were to, especially on the climate future side, was to identify regional climate change impacts and look at these impacts in two ways. One, determine the impacts determine the effect of these impacts on transportation, land use, energy, natural resources, but then switch it around and look at it conversely and ask the question of what impact would our policy choices have today on these kinds of impacts in the future? Would it make them worse? Would it make them better? A couple of examples here, increasing density in areas at less risk of these climate change impacts and creating buffers around areas that are identified as high risk. And these are a couple images from this study that occurred while we were in the process of this project, some flooding in downtown Albuquerque, and then also some wildfires in the nearby surrounding forests. I mentioned partners, we had quite a few. So funding partners were led by the Federal Highway Administration, BLM, National Park Service, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We had several supporting federal agencies that played a role either in participating or providing data and information. Our regional and local agencies were right there in central New Mexico. Mr. Cog, the Mid-Region Council of Governments, was our main partner in this project. And then we brought on a few consultants, Ecosystem Management and also the University of New Mexico. So for developing the climate futures, we looked at downscaled CMIP-3 climate projections. We based our work on 112 model runs, and that was that were conducted by 9 models using 3 different emission scenarios. This downscaled data was supplied by the Bureau of Reclamation Technical Service Center, of our partners. And the variables that we were most interested in are listed here, but centered mainly around precipitation and temperature changes. The projection range that we used was kind of historic, 1950 up to the present day, and then all the way up to 2099. We were able to create a model, and this was mainly Chris's work, that created 369 grid cells with eighth degree downscaled CMIP-3 climate projections. And I know things have progressed since this time, but so you can kind of consider this a historic review. But at the time, we felt that this was pretty good for the region that we were working with. And you can kind of see how those grids cover cover the study area. We could select any year up to 2099 and kind of zoom in to these different grid cells. Again, you know, have information about the inputs, and then the outputs are similar to what I listed before. But looking at more of the extremes, days above 100 degrees, thinking about cooling degree days, thinking about drought length as well. Here are the three scenarios we used, our emission scenarios. For CMIT-3, we used the A2 high scenario, A1B medium scenario, and B1 low scenario. These, I'm sure, could be updated at this point and probably are not all that relevant, but at the time, it was the best we could do. We then scatter plotted the results of the model runs here on this graph. Here, we're looking at a change in annual precipitation and a change in annual average temperature. And we can see there's not a lot of agreement. And this is not uncommon in different parts of the country, but particularly in central New Mexico, where you have a basin and range topography where you've got valleys that can get quite hot and dry. You've got mountains that are cooler and a bit wetter. And it wasn't clear where those climate impacts were going to have change. Where climate change impacts were going to affect, how they were going to affect these areas over the time frame. So we felt that this scatter plot approach was kind of the best shot that we could take, and then we created these scenarios accordingly. So here we have really five climate futures, dividing the graph up into quadrants: a warm wet future, a hot wet future, a hot dry future, and a warm dry future, as well as kind of a central cluster as well. So roughly this divided the model runs into five equal groups. We could also select, because of that basin and range topography, we wanted to be able to select individual grids to zoom in on. So here we have some that are down the valley floor, some in urban areas, some in rural areas, and then ones up in the national forest and surrounding mountains to try to get a sense of what differences there may be based on elevation and other considerations. The result here is for one grid cell, looking at 2040, because primarily for long-range transportation plans and comprehensive plans, you're looking about 30 years out, 25 to 30 years out. So we chose 2040 as the planning horizon. And we were able to look at what those temperature changes in this case would be under those five different climate futures and graph it out by month. So you can see that the change would be more significant in those summer months than in those winter months. But across the board, you would see an increase in temperatures according to our models. Same kind of story for 100 degree days. So here is kind of a look at each of those six grid cells, and not much change in those higher elevation ones on the right side of the page, where you know, there's not many days, if any, above 100 degrees now, and there's not supposed to be or projected to be in the future. But as you get lower in elevation, and especially as you get onto the valley floor near Albuquerque, you start seeing some pretty large changes, significant changes in 100 degree days, particularly in under some of the scenarios and the warmer, drier months. Here's looking at precipitation in the same way. A little bit more color here, if you will, where there's changes across the board on regardless of the elevation. And this kind of shows what I mentioned before, that there's not agreement between the models and that there could be more precipitation, it could be less. We try to get a handle on if it would be more, you know, is it because there's higher intensity storms or what have you. And what we essentially learned was we've got to kind of plan for all the possible futures here. We know it's going to get warmer. We're not sure how much warmer. It may get drier. We're not entirely sure about that, but let's not put all of our eggs in one basket. Let's try to plan for as many of these futures as possible. So we developed this kind of summary slide that shows all the different changes summarized for each of the futures, looking at those parameters, those variables that we selected at the onset. And this became kind of a touchstone for the planning decisions that we made later on. So specifically, you know, how do we make these resilient investments, as we call them, ones that could stand up again with regards to as many of these climate futures as possible? These are multi-million dollar investments that the region's planning to make in the next few years. They want to make sure they have some resiliency, some staying power over the coming decades. So we looked at areas that were at risk from any of those different types of impacts. We looked at where development maybe should be steered away from over time. And we looked at energy simply because one of our main partners was the energy company there in the region. And they were, again, most interested in cooling degree days. So we tried to project, you know, what do they need to be prepared for with regards to the grid? And because we worked with several federal land management agencies, we looked at the impacts on the natural and cultural resources, not just wildfire and flooding, but actually, you know, what are those impacts then going to be on riparian habitats that are very sensitive in the area and threatened endangered species. And again, another picture, you know, this area that had a sign that said the road may flood, certainly did in August of 2014 while we were there, and the underpass became unusable except for pedestrians walking a balance beam of sorts here. This work really generated a lot of information that we are happy to share. The caveat is it's a little outdated at this point, but here's our web link. We can get this to you, I think, through the notes as well. But we have reports from not only the project as a whole, but for each specific agency that helped fund our work. The contractors came up with technical reports as well. So we have kind of high level summaries. We have more in-depth studies as well. And they're all on our website here. My contact information, as well as Chris, is posted here. And our other colleague, Alex Epstein, which was kind of the go-between between Chris and I, he couldn't be here today. He's on paternity leave, but he also is very knowledgeable in this work. And if Chris and I can't answer your questions here in the next few minutes, we can get a response from Alex later on. So with that, I'll turn it back to you, Jean, for any questions.
All right. Thank you so very much. So just a quick gentle reminder, we still have just a moment or two here where we can take some questions from the audience. And I'll just encourage the audience to go ahead and use that Q&A space if you have a question. If you'd like to raise your hand and ask your question out loud, we can go ahead and allow some time for that now. So there should be a hand raise button in the bottom in the Zoom controls. I'll call your name out when I see that hand go up. And for those of you who might only be listening on the phone, I know I have a few callers who are just listening and kind of following along manually with those slides. If you hit *9, on your phone keypad, that should raise your hand in Zoom on the phone line, and then I can call on you to unmute yourself. And as I am waiting, I'm seeing some messages coming in here. So there were some similar questions that I'm starting to see pop up here in the queue in terms of updates, schedules for your model. Can you talk a little bit about the frequency of how you'll be updating the model?
Yeah, we did have the model, you know, up to date during the life of the program or project. And I think there was a new data source that we integrated about partway through. But since that time, the model has not been updated. We did a lot of this work for the Park Service, a lot of the climate futures work, since they have a climate change scenario planning program as well. And we turn this work over to the Park Service. We know that they have integrated this work into some of the projects that they've since worked on, but they didn't really keep the model as it was in the same form. And so there is no updated version of this model. That being said, it could be updated. We're happy to do so. You know, I think Chris, maybe you can jump in here as to, you know, is this pretty open source? Is this something that anyone could do? We're very open to seeing this tool go on and evolve over time.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Ben. I think, you know, one of the parts of this project was to try and make the model, or at least the script that we ran, you know, as open source and as modular as possible. So when we handed it off to our sponsors, it wouldn't be some black box that they didn't know how to use. So there's documentation with that as well. And like you said, we'd be happy to share that with anyone who's interested.
Okay. We did have a couple of people sort of chime in about the lack of agreement amongst the various models that are out there, and that just creates a lot of uncertainty with the work that then uses those models since they're not in agreement. And so they were wondering if you might talk about any advances in modeling or hopes where these things might start to converge or line up better in the future.
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. And I have to admit, I'm a little out of the loop on that. I was engaged with this work from 2010 to 2015. And then just because of the project work that my sponsors took me in, I got away from this work. So Chris, I don't know if you have any insights. I think Alex would, but he's not here, so I may have to kind of kick the can on this. But Chris, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think Alex would be a good resource on the particulars of the model. But, you know, to emphasize one of your points, Ben, I think, you know, another aspect of this tool was to be able to, you know, look at many different scenarios at once. And even if there is no particular, you know, good agreement on the area of concern, you know, at least you have some idea of maybe a probability of, you know, that particular scenario. It so happened that the predictions that we had were pretty evenly split between those five, you know, futures that we labeled, but that's not always necessarily the case for any particular site.
Okay. And so there was a generalized question. So overall, when we increase heat, will that cause an increase in evaporation of surface water in the drier areas if we end up with like a warmer or drier season? Is that generally a fair statement?
I think so. I remember that coming up, and this is an area that doesn't have much, if any, humidity. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that surface water is lost under these higher temperature scenarios. And I'm not sure how our model captured that, but certainly that's a concern. We did work with the water agency there in the region, looking at kind of how this could impact nearby reservoirs. And again, kind of gave this information over to them to do with it as they'd see fit. But yeah, they were part of the conversation. I think that was an issue of that did come up.
Okay. Can you comment if there were any legal concerns if, let's say, the model winds up generating reduced future property values as a result of what it kind of draws in its conclusions? Have you addressed that or run into that?
Not personally. So our partner was the Mid-Region Council of Governments. They have that kind of planning area there I showed previously. I'll zip back to that. This is kind of their four-county region around central New Mexico. And this map does try to capture kind of, this is actually landowners, but we have another map that shows here's where flooding impacts may be, here's where wildfire impacts may be. The whole area is kind of impacted by temperature change. And we didn't get down to the parcel level. We did try to kind of highlight generally that this area maybe would be less advantageous for investment and development compared to other areas, specifically around arroyos where there could be flash floods. But I think that being that this was a long range plan, it didn't get to that level of specificity. However, Mr. Cog, our local partner, that was a next step that they could take, is to kind of drill down a little bit more and say, all right, well, let's look at our flood maps. Let's take a look at, you know, the buffer that we have with regards to our forested lands. and see if we need to make some changes in how we invest in these areas. And nothing legal came up, but I think with the planning organization there on the ground, there could be some implications, but none that I've heard of.
Okay. And there was a question here about the Volpe Center. They wondered if you provide climate vulnerability assessment technical supports for specific projects, like let's say the Federal Highway Administration, when they're doing a highway project, can they reach out to you and get specific technical assistance with their work?
I think the Volpe Center, we have over 500 employees, and I'm kind of, say on the right hand, I don't necessarily know what the left hand is doing, but Chris, maybe you can jump in, or Chris Zavitas, who's part of this group, maybe you'd like to jump in on that. We do that kind of work and have over time, but I'm not sure what the current state of it is currently.
So I know Chris is here. I'm going to go ahead and allow him, if he wants to pop on and address or share any response that he can. So Chris, you're now connected. If you want to unmute and respond, feel free.
Sure. The Volpe Center works on a cost reimbursable basis for, mostly for federal sponsors, but we also do work for states, for municipalities. Technically, we even do work for the private sector, and we do work across a range of disciplines, including this type of scenario planning, and we're available to talk to anyone who may be interested in talking to us.
Okay, excellent. All right, well, I don't see any other questions here in the queue at this point. So we're almost right on track with the agenda, gentlemen. So I want to thank both of you, as well as you, Chris, as well, for chiming in there at the end to help with the questions. So why don't we go ahead and take down this current presentation, and we'll carry on with our agenda. So Ben, I'm going to just jump in here and say, I believe it's Sophia Lee who's up next on the agenda. Sophia, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
All right, excellent. So Sophia, I will go ahead and turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Jane. Let me just pull up the presentation here. And share my screen. Just make sure that you can see everything all right.
Everything's perfect.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I want to wish a good morning and good afternoon to our audience and also our presenters today. My name is Sophia Lee, and I'm a hydrogeologist over here in Port Hueneme, California for Naval Facilities Engineering and Expeditionary Warfare Center. And today I'm going to be taking you down the rabbit hole, so to speak, into a case study where we've encountered sort of an interesting situation where climate change has impacted the way that we do things for a remediation site out at Naval Weapons Station Seal Beach. So moving on to the next slide here. The first thing I wanted to mention is some goals that were discussed last week and brought up by Kim Brown over at NAFAC headquarters on the previous meeting. So NAFAC has three main goals when it comes to climate change. And the first is to identify and assess the effects of climate change on DoD installations, particularly the long-term effectiveness criteria of the CERCLA process. The second goal was to integrate those climate change considerations across the DoD and manage associated risks. And the third was to collaborate with internal and external stakeholders on climate change challenges. And we really felt like this case study encompasses a lot of aspects of each of these three goals. Now, climate change isn't new to the Department of Defense, and we heard about that last week by some great presenters from the Department of Defense itself. And I also wanted to bring attention to a few reports that have come out from the Department of Defense related to climate change, and they're applicable to the case study that we see today. The first is a 2014 Department of Defense Climate Change Adaptation Roadmap. And it named rising sea levels and associated storm surge as one of the four primary climate change related phenomena likely to impact DoD installations. This report was followed up by a 2019 report from the Government Accountability Office, which found that the DoD installations have not consistently assessed these risks, exposing facilities to greater than anticipated damage from climate change phenomena like sea level rise. Now, sea level rise impacts not only involve surface water related events such as storm surge or flooding, but they can also impact groundwater flow. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. So let's think about how sea level impacts groundwater flow when it comes to climate change. If you look at the figure on the right, I have a schematic of just the basic physical structure of what's happening in the ground at the coastal interface. And most importantly, I want to bring your attention to the saline water versus groundwater intermixing zone at the coast. So in general, and let me pull up an annotation feature here. Here we go. We have, can you see my annotation all right?
Yes, we can see the cursor and the arrows on the slide.
Oh, great. Thank you. So as you can see, in general, we have infiltration up gradient from the land surface, infiltrating down into groundwater at typically as freshwater, and then discharging at a coastal margin where it mixes with saline water from an ocean or a sea. In general, you have pressures from upgradient locations, causing an intermixing zone known as the saltwater wedge, where brackish water can be present. And we think of this as a triangular shape, as saltwater is denser than groundwater. So you're going to see the saltwater typically flow farther inward at deeper locations in the ground than necessarily at the shore where the freshwater is discharging. When you have an increase in sea level, however, this causes a change in pressures at the shoreline, leading to the need for physical balancing of the saltwater wedge. And as you can see in this figure down below, with an increase in sea level, we have an increase in the saltwater wedge. And even though freshwater may be discharging, it's likely to discharge at a further inland point in the subsurface or at a lesser rate as you look at those balancing pressures. And this is basic physics. Right. Now, if we look at this in the terms of Southern California, the Bureau of Reclamation in 2013 released an estimated mean sea level change along the Southern California coast to be about 1.5 to 12 inches by 2030, 5 to 24 inches by 2050, and 16 to 66 inches by 2100. And so in general, this is something that we need to take into account when we're thinking about how groundwater resources and anything involving groundwater is going to be impacted when it's interacting with saline water at the coast. So how does this impact restoration? And I seem to have lost my mouse. Let's turn off the arrow. There we go. There we go. So if we have a situation where we have had contamination infiltrate from the surface, and usually with a lot of our contamination sites, that's what's happening, is you've spilled something at the surface, or you have an underground storage tank that might have leaked and it will infiltrate through the vasozone, reaching the water table. When we're assessing that for remedial design purposes, we will take the groundwater flow gradient as well as the level of the ocean body or the coastal body into account when designing our remedial action. So, and typically these plumes are also in the shallower zone since they're coming from the surface over time. So when you're thinking about it in terms of sea level, you do need to take into account the fact that you have potentially a decrease in gradient at the surface from a rise in sea level, but typically you won't necessarily be as concerned about the intermixing of or extent of a brackish zone from a saltwater wedge. In general, though, the impacts of sea level rise are going to be highly dependent on the distance of your remediation site from the coast, and therefore pretty darn site specific. So in the case of the infograph that I have here, you can see that the plume is pretty shallow and farther inland, so it's not at the coast. But if it was, say, right here, for example, farther towards the coast, then you might need to take into account that brackish intermixing zone. Generally, long-term tidal influences on gradients are not considered to be a major concern for many remediation projects, but would be considered in the five-year review process. In reality, though, we don't typically live in a perfect world where we have a contaminated site and nothing else going on besides sea level rise. Typically, we'll see that most military installations that are near the coast also include either site-specific infrastructure or near population centers. And with the presence of human activity come additional considerations and impacts on sea level rise that we need to take into account. So what am I talking about here? If we go back to this notion of we have a groundwater plume in the shallow zone, we put in a remedial action plan and we are tracking that as time goes on. Well, there might be, say, a municipality nearby that is doing things in the groundwater or in the regional aquifer that need to be taken into account, both in terms of their impact on the plume and their impacts as they change from sea level rise. And we can see that in the infographic here. So in this case, I have a municipality which has a pumping well or a pumping field that's impacting the aquifer at depth. Now, in terms of my groundwater plume, when the sea level rises in this lower figure, I'm not as concerned because the gradients still have flow moving outwards. Whatever remedial design we've put into place would still be considering that when dealing with the issue. However, if we look back farther up gradient, we now see that the groundwater well field for the municipality is being impacted by a brackish water zone. And so ultimately in this case, it's likely that that municipality would have to put in mitigation strategies in order to address the impacts of the rising sea level on their groundwater field. And these can take a variety of forms. And what sort of forms might be put into place is a very good question, because all of these have different potential impacts to our remediation site. So some of the types of remediation strategies that could be put into place to address this issue could include reductions in regional pumping, surface water control mechanisms in the form of riprap or seawalls, et cetera, an infiltration barrier, or the relocation of production centers to accommodate or minimize saltwater intrusion at depth as it's getting to that well field. And one of the things I haven't mentioned here, but that is something to keep in the back of your mind, is that each of these is extremely expensive. And so it's something that you want to consider before moving forward with any of these designs. So let's take a look at one of these as it impacts our case study. And in this case, it's an infiltration barrier. So what is an infiltration barrier? An infiltration barrier in this case is a series of injection wells set at various depths throughout the aquifer to act as a physical pressure wall to hold back saltwater intrusion from coming into your aquifer. And you can see that here in the schematic in purple on the left. So in this case, if we put in an injection barrier here, it would effectively push back the salt water such that your groundwater municipal well field would still be able to pull fresh water, counterbalancing the impacts of the sea level, which is great until you raise the question of, okay, well, how does that impact our remediation site? And that is exactly what we had to answer in this case study today. What are the impacts such activities could have on plume migration for a shallow groundwater plume that would be in between an injection barrier and a coastal margin? So let's look at that. Today, we're gonna be talking about Naval Weapons Station Seal Beach, IR Site 70. Naval Weapons Station Seal Beach is located in Orange County in the downgradient portion of the Santa Ana River watershed. And I've highlighted in orange the approximate location where it is in this cross section. In general, this area is defined by unconfined conditions at depth with semi-confined conditions in the shallow zones. It's thought that the Newport-Inglewood Fault, if you're familiar with the area, and I do have a map further on if you're curious, can act as a barrier to coastal seawater intrusion. However, it's been shown to be leaky in parts. And so therefore, when you have inland groundwater levels that are below sea level, or a rise in sea level that causes that down the line, then you can have intrusion of salt water occurring in vital areas in the lower aquifers. So even though it might be very thin up here, it may cause impacts to well fields farther inland. And in general, at the moment, salinities in the principal aquifer are generally more on the freshwater side. However, there's certain areas that have been identified as problem areas for the water district or potential areas of high seawater intrusion. And one of them is the Sunset Gap intrusion area right underneath or right near where the art installation is. So what is the salt? What is the Sunset Gap? Well, the Sunset Gap is an area of potential leakiness on the area of the fault. It's been monitored since the 1950s as a potential location for seawater intrusion. And the Water District completed some scientific investigations in that area, which determined that saltwater intrusion through the gap could likely be prevented through the installation of additional injection wells in the form of a seawater intrusion barrier. So now we've talked about the area, let's talk about the plume itself. The contamination present at IR Site 70 is a DNAPL plume, which is approximately 10 to 50 feet below ground surface and occurs over an area of 23,000 square feet. The dissolve phase portion of this plume is 4,000 feet long and goes down to a depth of approximately 160 feet below ground surface. The area in which the dissolve phase plume occurs is complex geologically in the shallow. However, it has five primary subzones and is separated from the principal aquifer by a very thick clay layer that is contiguous at the base. In order to remediate this plume, an installation of a series of PRBs or permeable reactive barriers were put into place between 2008 and 2010, and emulsified vegetable oil was utilized to stimulate in situ bioremediation of the dissolve phase plume as it is moving down gradient. So as this installation and as the remedial site is located within the area of the Sunset Gap, when we were looking at this and looking at water levels in the area, concern was raised that there could be some potential impact of the planned injection system on the shallow groundwater plume. And just for scale, here is Site 70 within the model domain. So why were we concerned? In general, the principal aquifer is well below our site. There's a contiguous clay layer. So what's really going on here that would make us concerned? Well, like I showed in the beginning slides, you can't just install an injection barrier necessarily in your aquifer of concern because you're going to have sea level impact. Because of the wedge effect, you're going to have sea level rise impacting all areas along that wedge. And if we just look at a rough cross section of what's going on in this area, you can see, and I've highlighted in blue here, the areas of the cross section or the geologic log structure where the dissolve phase plume was present. And most importantly is the fact that it is present within the shell horizon unit and the second sand. So in that 105 to 170 unit or the alpha zone, which is the top area where the injection barrier would presumably need to be installed. And I just want to highlight that this injection barrier has not already been installed. It's still in the planning phases, which is why it's so important that we assess this now as opposed to later. So that's exactly what we did. Orange County Water District provided us with a modified Sunset Gap model. We took that model, we converted it to steady state in order to do some preliminary assessments on our questions. We did some calibration, and for those modeling nerds out there, we have the observers, the simulated plot here, as well as some of the statistics. We also added some additional surficial aquifer units to accommodate the full extent of the plume within the area of the model. And then we simulated potential extent of plume deviation, if any, using particle tracking. So what did this all look like? In general, particle tracking, and let me describe this a little bit first on the figure on the left. As you can see here, we have four images showing different sections of the upper units. So you have the upper fines, the first sand, the shell horizon, and that second sand, all above those contiguous clay units I was talking about, right? You have red circles on the map showing the approximate locations of injection wells. You have some goldenrod circles on the map showing some extraction wells that were part of this injection barrier design. You have a red trapezoid representing the approximate structure of IR Site 70. And then you have multicolored squiggles on there too, if you look really close, coming out of that trapezoid, representing the current footprint of the plume as you go down in the plume structure, right? And from there, not to give away the the end of the story, but you have lines deviating from that. And those lines were our preliminary particle tracking. And those are the green, goldenrod, and purple lines, right? So in general, particle tracking suggested that the large injection system at depth could contribute to change even in the shallow zones where the dissolved phase plume was currently present, causing a deviation from the current plume footprint. And from this, we said, oh, goodness, perhaps further work with regional stakeholders would be a good idea here in order to balance out the needs of our restoration site with the needs of the injection system to alleviate sea level rise as it is impacting the region as a whole. Now, this is just one IR site, right? And so it's really small potatoes when it comes to the overall impacts of saltwater intrusion on the principal aquifer in the system. And that's why it was determined that further work with regional stakeholders is anticipated to alleviate deviation from the plume footprint without it causing severe impacts to the region as a whole, right? So what are some final conclusions and remarks that we can take from this case study? The first is that sea level rise is a DoD priority for installation resiliency and warfighter protection. And it's something that we're looking at across our portfolio to make sure that we can keep our installations safe, our warfighters safe, and also support efforts of local communities as best we can. The second is that groundwater can be impacted both directly and indirectly from sea level rise. It's not just a storm surge question. It's also what's happening in the ground that we need to take into account. Anthropogenic considerations can also change the game, so to speak. Human beings don't necessarily like to sit back and wait for things to change before we try and mitigate the impacts. And so those mitigation activities, as they're designed and implemented, need to be taken into consideration in terms of our current remedial activities. Any major changes in flow direction ultimately need to be assessed regarding their impact to site remedy, and some of those may need to be addressed sooner than the five-year review process would necessarily have in place, right? In the case of this case study, more investigations were warranted after initial assessments show the potential for remedy impacts when assessing this injection barrier. And finally, it was determined that the best path forward towards addressing these impacts would be a proactive one, rather than waiting after the installation of a mitigation strategy to try and figure out a better way to assess the situation. And so with that, I would like to thank you, the audience, for listening today. I'd like to thank our stakeholders, as well as Orange County Water District, for their support. And I'd like to open it up to questions.
All right. Thank you so very much. Sophia, I'm going to start with a comment that came in earlier from one of the attendees. And as I read this, because it's a pretty long quotation that they put in here, I'll just remind the live audience that they can absolutely continue to type their questions in for Sophia into the Q&A window. And then, of course, if you'd like to ask a question out loud or verbally, if you're on the phones, hit *9 to raise your hand. Or again, a participant, you can press the hand button to raise your hand, and we'll see if we can take some verbal questions. All right. So getting back to this comment, the participant mentioned something called the quote, hazard mitigation assistance and mitigation planning final rule. And they said that it was placed, it was put in place in September of this year, that FEMA published in the Federal Register a rule that indicates an update to the hazard mitigation assistance programs to incorporate requirements enacted by the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012. And so this rule supposedly will be in effect as of October of this year. There's some updates to terms and definitions and improve consistency among FEMA's hazard mitigation programs. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with that rule or how it might impact work.
No, but it certainly would be interesting to see how it would impact legacy or restoration sites. So I'll have to hit you up for that, Jean, later to make sure I can follow up with our internal staff.
Sure. Okay. Our next question gets into monitoring strategies. So can you talk a little bit about the monitoring strategies in this particular example? They really want to understand how strategies might have been used to assess both the projections as well as the remedial efficacy. Could you do it in one shot, or did you have to have different monitoring strategies to measure each one of those metrics?
Ooh, well, that, you know, that's a really interesting thing to think about. So when it comes to one of the things I should say up front with this case study is that it didn't necessarily, we didn't go out there thinking, oh man, the climate is changing. We need to consider how it's assessing our site. That's typically not how, you know, it's a goal, but when you're looking back at, when you're looking in your restoration portfolio or your remediation portfolio, the first thing you're thinking about is, okay, how's my plume behaving? How's my remedy behaving? How are things going from the last 5-year review? How do I need to update it for the next 5-year review, right? So think about it rather than the big picture, in the weeds. And the first thing that we saw at this site that sort of sparked our interest is we saw gradients that had shifted way back between, I think it was 2015 and 2017. And that correlated with some other saltwater intrusion barriers way up gradient. And so we were thinking, well, is there something going on here? Why would we have our gradients shift direction a little bit? What's going on? And so that's when we reached out to Orange County Water District and said, hey, you know, we want to take a look at gradients. Do you guys have a model available that maybe we could use to support this effort? And that's what led us down this rabbit hole, the sunset gap analysis, and additional support from that. So from that perspective, you could say, well, quarterly monitoring of water levels at the site or semi-annual monitoring of water levels at the site was done first. And that maybe if you wanted to do any mitigation, you would have to think about, well, are our wells in the right place to provide that mitigation? But in the case of this site, we sort of have it as two different pieces because we do our monitoring to support the CERCLA process and support our restoration activities. We might need to think about, is that monitoring also applicable if we're going to be assessing additional changes in the groundwater as it's impacting our site? Now, at the moment, I think that they overlap. So it would be one monitoring effort, but that's something we're going to need to think about and work with stakeholders to figure out ultimately in the long term.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Someone wanted to know, was there consideration in running a transient simulation?
So in follow-up work, I think a transient simulation would be very appropriate here. We did a steady state simulation in this case because we just wanted to look at, okay, let's do a quick pass through. Let's, you know, get some back of the envelope style calculations in a sense, because it's still a groundwater model. So you're not doing it on paper, but let's get some basic understanding of what's going on. Is it worthwhile to do further investigation? And based on what we've seen, you know, these are preliminary results. Obviously, an injection barrier has not been put into place. We're saying, oh, okay, well, maybe this is something that we want to work with the water district on. Maybe we want to look at a little bit more internally as well to see, okay, what's the best path forward here? But yeah, I think a transient simulation would definitely be a very appropriate next step when it comes to this modeling effort.
Okay. And just a couple of simple questions. Was this a numerical model? Was it 2D, 3D?
It was a 3D numerical model using ModFlow and ModPath for the particle tracking.
Okay. Very mm-hmm. excellent. Well, I think with that, we are right on track to move to our next speaker. So, Sophia, I will thank you for your time. And I am going to ask Carlos Pochon to come back on camera if we can. So Carlos, let me go ahead and put you up here. And again, thank you so much, Sophia, for your time. And no problem. Carlos, whenever you're ready, feel free to take it over. And you're still muted, Carlos. No, let me see if I can help you out here. There we go. All right, everything looks great. Go ahead.
Great. Well, Sophia, thank you very much for that presentation. That was excellent. Right on mark. Really appreciate it. And clearly, the type of analysis you did, especially when it comes to deciding whether or not to move forward with an adaptation measure, is the closer we get and the more expensive that decision is, for example, the better understanding we want to have of those systems and whether or not that change merits the investment. So I'm going to close out with some one slide summaries of some examples of adaptation measures that have been implemented at Superfund sites. So we've discussed some of the process that one might go through to evaluate climate change at a location, how that climate may affect or has affected site conditions, and what adaptation measures we may consider. And now I'm going to go right into some examples of adaptation measures that have been put in place at at several Supercon sites and keep an eye on the clock. I also take the opportunity to reiterate the importance of the conceptual site models. Sophia's presentation was right on. It really helped us hammer that home. One of our experiences in conducting optimizations across more than 300 sites over 20 years is a precursor to which we come back and revisit the CSM. Sometimes it may have been sitting idle for a few years, or sometimes there may be a certain area that was not looked at close enough and that has since changed. No matter the motivation to be there, I want to insist on the importance of having a current CSM, conceptual site model, and using it as a tool to analyze remedy site operations, et cetera. And specifically, there are three areas that are potentially three aspects that may require a closer look when it comes to climate change. And that is the geology and hydrogeology, as we just heard, intended reuse and how that might affect contaminant. And then related to that, the pathway receptor network. But all of these are important, and it's really important to continuously keep an eye on the conceptual site model as the site evolves and conditions around the site evolve. So I'm going to quickly go through a few examples of how resilience is being factored into the Superfund program. I borrowed from my colleagues. These are not projects I have been involved in individually. We did, of course, check with them on some of the content here. And I want to go through basically the life cycle, site life cycle, the pipeline, if you want, from record of decision to design to construction operation, O&M. Examples from sites in those phases from across all 10 EPA regions. So the first one is the Gowanus Canal in New York City in Region 2. This is a very large project, a sediment project, which by nature tend to be very, very large. This is a close to $1 billion remedy range. And this is some example of some language. This is back from 2013. So the record of decision is already almost eight years old. And as you can see, it specifically identifies under the section on selected remedy, it states that the record of decision states that the capacity of the retention tanks will need to accommodate the projected additional loads to the combined sewer system as a result of current and future residential development, as well as periods of high rainfall, including future rainfall increases that may result from climate change. So in other words, in the records of decision, that's one of the questions that we had earlier, we are already seeing this. That was 2013. More recently, another sediment site, Portland Harbor in Oregon, a 2017 record of decision, also under the area of the septic remedy part of the rod, states that caps will also be designed to withstand more frequent floods with higher peak flows, more common with climate change. So we have some very good examples of how climate is being worked into records of decision out there. Sometimes at the rod level, it is broad. It has an expected issue that needs to be addressed. It doesn't have the specifications of how that adaptation will be designed. But it will have, caps will also factor in appropriate design levels to address the issue. Further down under statutory determinations, there's some more specific language about how the climate analysis was conducted. And then we have a third one here. This is the South Jacinto waste pits in Houston, Texas. Excuse me, this is a 2018 rod. And under the summary of the rationale for the selected remedy, we also find some discussion here about climate analysis models that indicate an increase in the frequency with which the area is going to be subjected to severe storms, including hurricanes. It is on the Gulf of Mexico. And then consequently, amongst the options that were considered, EPA selected a remedy that includes removal of contaminant materials above cleanup levels for the waste impoundments and monitor natural recovery for lower contamination level in the sand separation area. The point made here is that the rod indicates that changing climate conditions were a factor that informed the ultimate remedy decision at this coastal site in Galveston area. So we have another example from a rod. This one is a naval station, Newport Naval Site 22. This is a much more recent rod. This one is from 2020. And what we find here, again, in description of selected remedy, which is an asphalt soil cover system, we see that the design will ensure no net loss of beach or flood storage and will include storm and sea level rise considerations. And it is a little bit more specific. It indicates that the remedy will be designed to withstand a 500-year storm and will meet substantive requirements of the Coastal Zone Management Act. And in the responsiveness summary, some discussion, if you've ever seen a rod, it can be quite large, but Navy did state that current forecasts anticipate approximately 6 inches of sea level rise by 2033 and possibly 12 inches by 2050. And that was likely part that informed the ultimate decision. Okay, now we move out of the rod phase and we move into design and construction. We have this site here in Portsmouth. There's quite a history there from the record of decision back in 2008 through three explanations of significant difference in 2012, 2018, and 2021. Wanted to state that a lot of this information we have extracted either from the record of decision, from a five-year review, from documents of that nature, and then gone back to clarify any questions with the site team. But here, this is in Portsmouth, Virginia. The primary hazard is sea level rise. So what we saw here is an increase of the design height of an offshore pile wall to 12.5 feet from a local traditional 10 to 12 feet above mean sea level. In this case, the wall prevents dean apple migration to the Elizabeth River. And they constructed two berms with grass swales to collect and convey storm water runoff from two areas where dry sediment was placed at the cabin. So anyway, here we see a situation where there was an earlier record of decision, but modifications have been made to the operating system based on changing conditions. This is another example in remedy design and construction. This is the Davisville Naval Construction Battalion Center in North Kingston, Rhode Island. This is just about 50 miles south of Providence in the Narragansett Bay, beautiful part of the country. And what we saw here was, the primary hazard was a storm surge, a tidal force and wave action. And what they did is they raised a former landfill cap to an elevation higher than the feasibility study criteria to at least 14 feet instead of 10 feet above mean sea level. Several other examples of adaptation measures are included in this slide. Very interesting project, again, at the design and construction phase. So this is a situation where the remedy decision has already been made. The remedy is in place. What we're changing is design. Another example of that is the Malone Services and Superfund site in Texas City. Again, here, the primary hazard is again, flooding due to hurricane storm surge or sea level rise along the Galveston Bay. And what they did here, I think is interesting of this case, is that they used NOAA and other published storm surge simulation models to analyze storm surge and wave runup for different hurricane tracks, intensities, and forward speeds at different sea level rise predictions. So this, they did quite a bit of playing around or analysis to see what types of scenarios may be affecting that. And with the combined model results, they combined them with published past data of hurricane landfalls at nearby weather stations and buoys to identify a worst case scenario hurricane track. And they constructed an 18-foot levee to enclose two waste containment cells. They installed armor around the most vulnerable parts and they replaced topsoil with hydromulch and eroded areas after the Hurricane Harvey hit the area in 2017. Okay. So another design and construction example, this is a Rocky Mountain Arsenal, a site, very important site, just outside of Denver. Here what they had is a lot of containment remedies at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. And one of their primary concerns was drought and flooding. And in fact, the hazardous waste landfill design was built to withstand a 1,000-year storm. And maybe not surprisingly, it was put to the test. There was a 1,000-year storm event in 2013, which followed drought conditions. So we had a situation where vegetation on the cap was already stressed, and then a 1,000-year storm hit the area. It was preceded by drought conditions and followed by another year of heavy precipitation in 2014. This is a case study that was delivered at the NARPM training, the training we have for remedial project managers on climate resilience. Very interesting case study. It's true that the good news is that the remedy pretty much held out. There's certain areas that needed to be beefed up. But this is another example of during site operations, just something was designed in and it held. So one more example, a couple more examples actually. This one is in Vandale Junkyard in Marietta, Ohio. It's a 1994 rod, but what we have here is some really interesting discussion of how the site was prepared to manage changing more possible increases in precipitation and slope stability at this site. And the final one I wanted to discuss, this is already back in O&M, so this remedy is already out there. It was actually hit. This is Bridgewater, New Jersey, American Cyanamid Superfund site. There was a 2012 rod and a 2018 rod. This site was actually hit pretty hard by Hurricane Irene back in, I believe it was 2011, right? And in the five-year review they had, we talked about this earlier, they implemented some changes. For example, they elevated critical instrumentation to be 5 feet higher than the Hurricane Irene floodwaters. This site, as we have found with many, was impacted by the hurricane. There were no impacts on the remedy protectiveness. However, there was significant damage to remedy components and high cost of replacing that infrastructure. So this is a case where in the five-year review, in other words, the site is the remedy is already built. The site operations are in place. In this case, it was hit by a hurricane. And in the fire root process, they put in some adaptation measures to ensure its resilience going forward. So just a quick reminder that we have developed these fact sheets for contaminated sediment remedies, a waste containment systems, so basically caps and others, and then groundwater remediation systems. There's a fact sheet for each. A lot of this information did make its way into ARCX. So the system that Joel talked about this morning, it reflects some of the information here. But if you want, these fact sheets, we'll be updating them soon, but they're a very handy tool for typical system components for those types of remedies, what their climate vulnerabilities might be, and what adaptation measures have been put in place. And these are included in the resource package that we put together for this meeting. So with that, I appreciate your time, and I think I'm exactly on schedule to hand it over to Mr. Dan Powell, who will be providing some closing remarks on the 2 days of this FRTR meeting. Thank you very much.
We want to take a couple of questions first, or are we?
Oh, yep. Are there any questions, Jean?
Carlos, we have just someone pointed us towards a document on conceptual model planning and implementation from EPA on the life cycle of a CSM.
Okay.
So I can share that resource and then we can post it if you think that would be helpful to share with the audience. But there was a question, the case studies that you just walked through, are those summarized in a single EPA document somewhere, or are they just a bunch of individual fact sheets?
That's correct. There are several, they're sourced from several places, and what I heard in that question is exactly what we're intending to do. These are taken from, as I said, NARPM case studies, profiles we have put up there, different sources, but they're not compiled in this manner and in any other place. So hopefully we'll be able to provide that soon.
Okay. All right. Well, with that, we are exactly on time to move on to our next speaker. So let me go ahead and turn it over to you, Dan.
I appreciate that, Jean, and I appreciate all the speakers today, Carlos and Ben and Chris, Joel, Sophia, all the great presentations we heard today. And I guess you're really just down to final remarks here, and it's concluding the two-part fall 2021 meeting of the Federal Roundtable, and really highlighting the work the member agencies are doing to address climate issues in our federal remediation programs. Again, I want to thank the speakers for their contributions to the important discussion of how agencies and these programs can address this important and timely issue. And I'm sure those listening in and participating in this two-part series found the presentations informative and useful to the practice for mediation. The information exchange we have here is so important, especially when you have an issue that's getting the focus and priority of this. Actions and projects move quickly. Interactions such as this are incredibly valuable to maximize leveraging opportunities and sharing the work and the tools that are available across the cleanup community. As our Deputy Assistant Administrator Waterhouse pointed out on the session one last week, this type of collaboration ensures effective public administration in both the implementation of our programs and the use of public resources. With any endeavor so heavily dependent on science and technical expertise, it's incumbent on us as practitioners to ensure that we're on the leading edges of advances and continuing improvement of the tools and approaches to do the work. Over the years, our focus on innovation has come in many forms, whether it's looking at specific technologies or classes of technologies, whether it's looking at specific site challenges, or whether it's looking at new approaches and frameworks for applying innovation. We've always sought to improve our work through innovative practices and sharing of information. With these two sessions that just concluded, we are looking for ways we can apply our collective knowledge to ensure remediation practice and innovation and help us address the challenges of climate change, understand how we can adapt the practice and understand where our potential vulnerabilities lie and make certain remedies are resilient to the conditions we encounter. The sessions this month are not the beginning of the conversation. They're definitely not the end. As a group, we will consider what sort of follow-on activities we want to pursue, whether it's developing new information resources or whether to do further planning through maybe, focused groups to talk through this issue. We'll continue the dialogue through the Federal Roundtable. As always, I encourage you to revisit the presentations, which will be posted on the FRTR website, and you see the slide that's up on your screen right now. List the URL where you can find that, and also the matrix of available resources that was presented in session one and mentioned again today in Cindy's presentation will also be available there. As we have done in the past, we plan to pull together FRTR Presents webinars and either to rebroadcast these presentations more broadly and for folks who weren't able to attend today, or even augment the discussion on add more depth to some of the presentations as well. So please keep an eye out in your Tech Direct. That's where we announce upcoming Cluin webinars. If you're not part of Tech Direct and you don't subscribe to that, it's a monthly electronic newsletter that comes out, and again, it announces these sorts of opportunities. And you'll see the URL there in the bottom right-hand corner of the slide. And we're on the Cluin Studio site itself. And if you miss the live event, we always record and archive the sessions so they're available as podcasts. So in addition to the roundtable, there's probably over 800 technical podcasts that are available there. Finally, I want to thank those who organized and supported the agenda and the production of the fall meeting. This includes our meeting chair, Carlos Pichon, who serves as a Superfund expert on climate resiliency. The meeting committee, who including Tanya Gallegos from USGS, Kent Glover, the Air Force, Carla Hari from NAFAC, Heather Henry from NIHS, Tom Nicholson from NRC, Chris Avitas from the Department of Transportation. And also want to thank those responsible for the overall delivery of the program, including Cindy Frickle, who's the EPA staff lead for the roundtable, and Jean Ballant, who always provides a flawless delivery of these virtual events. And then again, we want to thank our support contractors, EMS, for helping make all of this possible as well. Lastly, I want to thank all those who participated. We appreciate your interest, first and foremost, and your input as well. It's been essential making sure that our content is relevant and vibrant and continues this 30-plus year run we've had as a group. I know we're running down on time here, and I want to just turn it back to Jean Ballant to provide any last sort of questions or discussion or point any other sort of housekeeping matters we may need to point out at the end. But again, thank you very much, and everybody take care.
All right. Thank you so very much, Dan. I'm going to echo your thanks. We had just under 300 people joining us for today's live broadcast. And I'm going to call up a few final reminders here on the screen before we go ahead and close things out. So, Dan, you were reading my mind, because I always like to remind the audience that you can visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. There are a variety of newsletters, RSS alert services, and other ways to stay connected to the information and resources we post there. And as you highlighted, we have a monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, that goes out on the first of each month and will highlight free online sessions like today's FRTR meeting. So I encourage you to sign up for Tech Direct if you're not already a subscriber. Another quick reminder is many of you have asked if there are copies of the presentation materials available. They are already posted. We have them on the seminar homepage. It's the same URL you were directed to join today's webinar. So if you go to that homepage, you'll see tabs along the top, and there will be a tab for the webinar slides. And if you click on that, you can download the slides. These materials are also posted on the FRTR website that Dan just highlighted. Information about our speakers and organizers are also posted there, so you can certainly reach out and contact them. If you have any problems locating a speaker, you can reach out to me. I'll be happy to help connect you to them if you have follow-on questions. And then I will ask that you follow the link to our online feedback form. You'll find that if you're looking at that seminar homepage in a tab called Feedback Form. I often get asked if we offer CEUs or PDHs for these sessions, and while I don't issue those types of credit hours, we can provide you with a participation certificate based on your attendance in the session today. So if you fill out that feedback form, at the very bottom of it, there will be a box that you can check to certify you were here for the entire delivery. And as long as you check that box and then submit your feedback, you'll immediately have access to a certificate like the one here on the screen that you can either print out or save for your own records. If you happen to have multiple parties joining you at your location, simply give them the URL to that seminar feedback form. They can fill it out on their own, even though they didn't register individually, submit their feedback, and still get their own certificate based on sitting in with you at your location. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, either through our online sessions or our podcast feeds, in the online interface, there should be in the upper right, just above my head, a link to the feedback form that you can click and fill out to get one of those certificates. So again, as I noted, today's session will automatically show up when the archive is available in an email in about 1 week. So you'll be able to replay it and as well share that with other colleagues that you think will find it valuable to listen to our session. And with that, again, I'll echo a big thanks to everybody involved in today's session, all of the speakers, all of the audience members, all of the support staff. And again, we hope that we will see you or have you connecting with us on a future Cluin webinar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today.